Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for joining us for the show today. We've got a lot of breaking news to talk about today. Among other things, if you're listening in real time, we're monitoring a news conference that the president is supposed to begin shortly. Tom Faust, our senior producer, is keeping track of it. I imagine we're going to hear the president say something about the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation and the problems that have arisen around it. So as we hear the president say things that we think we should share with you, we will do that throughout the show. And we will also talk about the Brett Kavanaugh story a little bit later in the show. We got some news here in Georgia we want to get to first. Let me introduce the panel, and then I'm going to take a minute to say something about yesterday's show. But let's go ahead and say hi to the panel. Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with us today. We're really glad you could be here today, Kevin. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Always a pleasure.
We have Dr. Andra Gillespie, Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science. Andra, you have been doing incredible service for GPB. We should have a Gillespie shuttle between your building on the Emory campus and GPB. We are so glad that we get to take advantage of your thoughtful analysis of politics. So thanks for being here again today.
No problem.
And a new colleague at Emory University, and Sangha Burton is back with us. And Sangha's in her first semester at Emory. You are, see if I got this right, the co-director of the media management discipline at Emory.
Yeah? Film and media management concentration. Yes, that is correct.
One of the things that's going to be interesting in having you join us in an ongoing way when we have things to talk about, it'll be really interesting to get you in here to talk about the commercials that we're seeing in the campaigns. And we'll do that on another show, but okay. Not today. Finally, Stephen Fowler, reporter for GPB News, is here. He's been tracking the federal suit that Amy Totenberg heard over whether or not the state should go to paper ballots. She ruled on that last night, finally. And Stephen, we're going to talk about that in just a minute. Excuse me. And Charles Bullock is with us from the studios of WUGA. Charles, if you're not the longest serving political science professor in Georgia, I can't imagine who is. Does anybody have more years in than you do?
I can't imagine they do. No, most people are smart enough to leave well before this point.
Charles knows more about Georgia politics, I think, than any of the people who I have in terms of our professional colleagues at the AJC in here combined. So, Charles, it's great to have you back on the show. All right. Before we start talking with the panel, I do want to make just a couple of remarks. Many of you heard yesterday's show, in which, among other things, we talked about an AJC article that appeared on Sunday, which really drilled down on the two nonprofits that Stacey Abrams founded back in the 2013 to around 2015 or 16. Talked about the salary she was paid. It talked about the results of her voter registration efforts, and it talked about the fact that the campaign did not want to release information about who the donors, $12.5 million worth of donations to these two nonprofits, were. I don't want to relitigate that story, but if you heard the show yesterday, you heard probably the most heated fighting we've ever had on Political Rewind between two of the panelists on the show, one a Democrat, one a Republican. And your response to it was, frankly, as negative as ours was. If you heard the show, probably heard me on any number of occasions ask the panelists to be more respectful of one another. They were so passionate and heated, they didn't want to do that. And so the conversation devolved into a fight. And I wanted to share with you, we had more comments on Facebook Live over this than any other day of the show. And I'm going to share with you just a few of the things that you all said out there. Doug Grover said, "Most disappointing thing for me was being unable to decipher what the panelists were saying during their mutual rantings." And then he went on to say of the Facebook Live community, "Nice thing about our commenting is that we can't stomp all over each other." David Chandler said, yeah, today was almost veering off the rails, and his message to me was, be calm, be calm. Daniel Eason said, there's nothing wrong with a little life in the debate. Just hold the panelists accountable for their claims. And there were a couple of you who said you sort of liked the interaction. And I won't really read a whole lot more of these. You can all go on Facebook Live. I read every one of them after the show was over. But, I'll read one more. Ivy, I read this yesterday, but it's worth repeating. Bill, I understand that fuses are running short and everyone is feeling the need to be defensive, but I've already debated tuning out today's form of, quote, debate, unquote. I appreciate each other's perspective, but not the fight. The hallmark of this show is respectful conversation, and we tell the panelists that we are so fortunate to have such a remarkable pool of analysts to call upon to do this show. And every now and then, things get overheated. And Kevin, one of the things that concerns me is that as we get closer and closer to November 6th, as many of our listeners pointed out, people's passions are more engaged than ever. My goal throughout the rest of this election season will be to offer our panelists an opportunity to express their very, very different, specific points of view, but to ask them to do it respectfully, because that's what our listeners want. And I assume in a way, you don't have it in real time, but the newspaper has to deal with the same kind of thing.
Right. We spend actually a lot of time, Bill, thinking about this, and I know that you do too. People want information so that they can make up their own minds. They don't really want to be told what they should think, and they really don't want to have anything forced down their throat. And I think, you know, we and you and some others of us in Atlanta and Georgia have to work really hard to provide that place where people can get information, try to understand what's going on, and make up their minds, because there's just too much at the extremes, too much over the top, too much trying to persuade people or just give them one side or one set of facts. And if this state and this community is going to be a great one and reach all its possibilities, we need a well-informed electorate and citizen.
All right. Well, I thank you for adding to that. I just wanted to make those brief remarks because we will continue. I do have to say, Tommy Burkhalter said on Facebook Live, I was craving a Xanax during the show. Tommy, if you think you were, how do you think I was feeling? All right. Let's plunge into the topics of the day. Stephen Fowler, we have been waiting for Judge Totenberg for some time now to rule on the lawsuit, which demanded that the state of Georgia go to paper ballots to assure some integrity in terms of the vote count. And she finally issued her ruling last night. She had to do it because we're fast approaching the election. And she turned down the plaintiff's lawsuit.
She did. The first thing she did is she actually denied the state's request to throw out the motion. So she said that there's enough evidence to continue with this lawsuit of sorting out how Georgia's election system will look in the future. But she hit a few things in her ruling. She had some very strong language, like you mentioned at the top of the show. She indicated that the defendants and state elections officials had, quote, buried their heads in the sands when dealing with Georgia's infrastructure, the 16-year-old voting machines, and potential problems and threats that came to it. Now, I just want to highlight quickly, Judge Totenberg did agree that the plaintiff showed the state's touchscreen voting system posed a concrete risk of ballot counts being inaccurate for the elections. Two, they showed a real risk of Georgia voters not being able to track their votes, how they voted, make sure that everything was entered in correctly. But ultimately, she said it was a matter of timing. Early voting starts less than a month from now, and the general election is 7 weeks away. And basically, she said that the state couldn't conceivably buy all of the materials needed, print all of the ballots, deliver all of the ballots, train all of the poll workers that would have to give out these paper ballots. And in fact, switching to paper ballots, she said, would actually make the election less secure, which is the opposite effect of what's intended.
Charles, you're kind of the away team here out of WGA, so I'm going to give you the first crack at this. It is important to note that Judge Totenberg really reconfirmed what the plaintiffs, the Coalition for Good Governance, was saying, which is we don't know that we can trust the outcome of the election. That's not good news for Georgia.
Well, no, but this is probably going to be the last time we're going to use that equipment. It's almost inconceivable we won't have something new. And these complaints go way back to the first year that they were in place. I remember getting a call right after the 2002 election from a reporter who was convinced that that Sonny Perdue had stolen that election. He just couldn't believe that if it had been done accurately that he would have won. So there's been a question mark hanging over these machines right from their inception.
Andre, it does strike me that Amy Totenberg's line about Georgia officials, election officials, putting their heads in the sand is going to pop up somewhere in a commercial against Brian Kemp in his gubernatorial bid.
Well, potentially. And here, I think, is the line for criticism. You're using machines that have been used since 2002. The laptop that I used in 2002 sits at my mother's house where it's been for the last 10 years and nobody uses it. And I think I'm on my third and my fourth one, you know, at this point. Machines update. And so if I were to try to bring that old machine back online, it actually couldn't do a lot of stuff that I would want it to do, but it would also actually be very penetrable at this point, given new technology. And so it's somewhat inconceivable that you think you can use the same machines over and over again. And I'm sure there's certain types of updates that have been going on, but to not expect that there aren't safer, newer models out there that can be used. And so, you know, I think the line that the Democrats will likely be using is that there is some sort of dereliction of duty in assuming that those same old machines are actually still workable.
Well, Kevin, we heard from Charles Bullock that in fact, these are going to be phased out. And we do know the Secretary of State's office has impaneled a group to look at new machines that will be used beyond November 6th. But two things are important here. Number one, as Stephen pointed out, and in a minute I want to ask him what this means, that this case has not been dismissed. It does still have life. I'm not quite sure what that'll mean. But the more important thing is this is a very volatile election. And for a federal judge to raise questions about the accuracy of the machines is troubling as people look to this crucial election on November 6th.
I agree with you. I think it's just silly, too, that it somehow has turned into a partisan issue. I mean, Georgia's one of the most important states in the union. We ought to be very, very serious about how our elections are conducted and the quality of those elections and the quality of the equipment that people vote on and use. I mean, it's just silly to even be in this kind of debate.
So, Stephen, what are the implications of the case not being dismissed?
Well, so what this means is for now, both sides have appealed. So the state is appealing. They still want this case thrown out. But the plaintiffs in the case, one of the plaintiffs, intended to get December's runoff election to be moved to paper ballots. Now, if November was soon enough, December probably would be too soon as well. But what this does do is that SAFE commission that you mentioned that Secretary of State Kemp has put together, there will be two parallel tracks, most likely, of this commission deciding how to move Georgia's election system forward and the judicial process potentially encouraging them strongly to move in a certain direction.
And Sangha, are you worried about what you when you go to cast your ballot that it's not going to be accurately registered, recorded?
I'm always worried when I cast my ballot that it's going to be counted. I think, you know, what everyone has said is apropos. It's shocking that we're having this kind of discussion in 2018 and right before such an important election. But I'm glad that it's out there. I'm glad that someone else, a federal judge, has ruled and said that, yeah, get your stuff together and that people will have to get their stuff together. So it'll be better going forward.
Our producer, Robert Jemison, talked to Marilyn Marks. She's the executive director of the Coalition for Good Governance. He talked to her just a short time ago to ask her for her response to how this case was decided. Here's what she told Robert.
You know, she ticked off all of the various claims that we had and, you know, the arguments against them that the state had. And in every case, she agreed with us. And she's saying, you are likely to prevail. The problem is November, the state has her in this, quote, catch-22 position where she feels that she can't second-guess them and say, no, there wouldn't be voter confusion. No, there would not be long lines. And I think that we could put in a lot of evidence to the contrary, but when you have the people who are running the election saying, hey, I'll create long lines, I'll create chaos, I'll make sure that you know, we reduce the early voting centers in order to create long lines, you know, that becomes a real issue.
Charles, it's interesting. Kevin Riley just said this has become a partisan issue, and you sure heard it in virtually every one of Marilyn Mark's words about what's been happening. She's, of course, talking about voter suppression. How do you react to that?
Yeah, it's not intentional. Maybe inadvertent. It may discourage some folks, and some people may think it's not even worthwhile to vote because they don't believe that their vote will be accurately counted. There's a lot of people going to vote early, and some of them may actually vote on paper. If you get an absentee ballot, you'll have paper to vote on. So if you want to make sure you have paper ballot and something that's traceable, that's one way to ensure that.
Andra, Marilyn Mark's comments certainly do make a case for people's nervousness about how this election's being run.
Well, I mean, people are nervous because this race is going to be close.
Yeah.
So we can't predict, who's going to win, but this race is definitely going to be close. And when you have such close margins, then that any amount of error, expected error versus sort of unexpected error, could actually spell the difference between winning or losing a race. So, I definitely understand the concerns. I mean, I think it's the responsibility of other people. I understand her position, but I think it's the responsibility of other people to make the case for why these systems need to be revisited, just on sort of generic nonpartisan good government types of things.
Yeah. Stephen Fowler, I want to thank you. You've been all over this from the very beginning, and thank you for your terrific reporting for GPB News, and thanks for joining us for a few minutes today.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's move on to a little conversation. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the governor's race right now. Kevin, the Kemp campaign yesterday unleashed an attack line against Stacey Abrams that appears to me to be one that they're going to take with them right to the finish line because I think they believe it really has legs. And what they've said is they've called into question the reasons that Stacey Abrams, as a state legislator, did not register a vote. Didn't vote no, didn't vote yes. She left the chamber on a vote over getting tougher penalties in place on sex trafficking. And of course, they're accusing her of being soft on sex traffickers. What do you make of this?
Well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes because, I have the sense that in both camps, this is the beginning of, it's like the first round of a heavyweight fight, and people are sort of circling the ring, seeing with what kind of punches they can land and what weakness they should keep going after. We'll see what happens. I mean, I think it's a little hard to believe that the electorate would believe that Tracy Abrams is somehow pro-sex trafficking. That seems like a little bit of a dangerous tack to take.
Well, part of the problem, I think, Charles, is that the campaign has been a little bit clumsy in the way they've responded to this. They weren't quite, why did she choose not to vote? I mean, the explanation is that she did not want to lock judges into sentencing requirements that she felt might be, should have more flexibility. But she didn't cast a no vote. She left the chamber. If you're in the chamber, you've got to vote in the Georgia legislature. So, Charles, and then they were a little hazy about whether she didn't agree with the measure in the first place. So, to some extent, it's up to the Abrams people now, if this line of attack isn't going to work, to straighten this out, isn't it, Charles?
Yeah, two things I'd say about it. One is that in Texas, this is what used to be referred to as an outhouse liberal, that you'd slip off the floor rather than cast a really hard vote and go to the restroom. The other thing I'd say is that this, I think, is going to be a hard issue for the Kemp camp to make voters aware of. And this is pretty much inside baseball. And so, this isn't going to fit on a bumper sticker. So it may be hard selling
if
they try
to
make a big issue of this.
Let me get Nsenga and then Andre in here. This is when I talk about, this is a powerful commercial, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, you simply say, okay, she's not in favor of locking up sex offenders. Yeah, I mean, again, we see things like that being portrayed, where it's not even kind of a half-truth.
And Senga?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very difficult to paint Stacey Abrams as someone who doesn't care about women, who doesn't care about the rights of women, who doesn't care about children, when she's been so vocal about those issues. And so even with, the types of advertisements we've been seeing, you know, the reason that there's a term, political attacks, that happens in campaigning, and that happens in political campaigning specifically. I do agree with Kevin that it is a mistake, I think, for the Republicans to try to make this an issue, you know, to position it as Stacey doesn't care about women and children. I think that's ridiculous.
So, Andrew, this will appeal to the base that that Kemp is appealing to. But the question is, how will it appeal to those women out there who aren't sure where they're going to go?
So what I suspect the motivation behind bringing this up is that, especially when you're thinking about white evangelicals, the one thing that young and old evangelicals agree on in terms of a social justice issue is sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. So that is probably what they're trying to hit at. And so they are thinking of suburban women. They're thinking of people who go to mega churches in metro Atlanta who are in the 6th and the 7th district, knowing that that is the vulnerable group for them. And I think they want to try to weaken that potential support for Abrams or, you know, that potential opposition to Kemp on these particular lines. And it's actually somewhat tough. I mean, you know, in the article that you gave us in preparation for this, you have the Kemp campaign saying, well, she should have just, like, you know, been courageous and voted no. And it's like when you would have attacked her for voting outright no in the first place.
Right,
and so that's always the problem with legislators is that they make lots of votes on issues and that, you know, you can criticize them for how they vote even on preliminary votes for certain types of things. So, you know, it's worth a try. I think it's a question of the frame that has already been created around Stacey Abrams and whether or not this is actually penetrable in serving to undermine that particular type of frame. But I'll point out, this has already made it into ads.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see sort of how effective it is.
You think it's undecided voters more so than...
Or conflicted voters.
Conflicted, yeah, right.
Yeah, but evangelicals are already voting 85-90% Republican, so yeah, it may reinforce some of that. But in terms of getting much beyond that, that may be harder.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the whole point is that you know, they are worried about losses in the North Metro area where college-educated white women, some of whom are conservative, might actually have some issues. So I agree that this is on the margins, but this is a race that I think people think is going to be won and lost on the margins.
All right. In the meantime, there's a PAC out there that is supporting Stacey Abrams, and they've launched a new attack on Brian Kemp. And what they've done, Kevin, is to have brought up all of the issues, really, what we started with today, a look at election security, voter registration, efforts to suppress voter registration, all of the things that relate to concerns about whether he has been an effective overseer of our election apparatus. And I wonder if in these days of Russian hacking and all of the concerns we have about that sort of thing, whether that might not be a fairly effective line of attack. If you can't trust him to run the Secretary of State's office and the elections, can you trust him to run the state?
Yeah, and you know, as you, I think, pointed out earlier, the federal judge who ruled in that case sort of gave the Democrats a line to use, this burying his head in the sand line, or I forget exactly.
Yeah, and Sanga, I expect to see that in an ad. Like, why isn't it already in an ad today?
Absolutely. I mean, it will be. I mean, absolutely, because it actually lines up. It's logical, right, if you're not doing this. And there's been some discussion about, you know, Kemp and him being the Secretary of State and overseeing this election process. And is that an ethical violation? Should he be involved as heavily because he's a candidate for governor and so forth and so on? But yeah, I mean, the judge laid it out. It makes absolute sense. It's like, okay, so it's okay as long as you're winning. When we have a tight race, now we have to have a different discussion. What does all of this mean? And at the end of the day, it is like, what has been going on under your watch? That's a reasonable question.
Yeah. Andre, do you think that's an effective line of attack?
Well, I mean, Casey Cagle tried to use it against him in the primary election. So,
He had so many other problems.
But, I mean, it was something that, had the tape not come out, might have actually been an effective line of attack. I mean, I'm assuming somebody tested it somewhere. I just haven't seen the data to be able to prove it. But it's not terribly far-fetched. And there are other things that, you know, some people could be reminded of. The fact that we have a longer runoff period, you know, that happened under Brian Kemp's watch. I mean, some people argue he wasn't vigilant in fighting against that to try to keep our runoff period to a shorter time span.
And we can explain that. Essentially, he did not defend the state from a federal rule, which required a longer runoff period for military servicemen and women to send their votes back. But there are people who thought Kemp could have fought that.
That he could have fought that a little bit better. And then in particular, in 2014, if those races had gone to a runoff, you know, it would have delayed the seating of the U.S. senator, past the actual start of Congress. And so there were some people who were grumbling at the time that smacked of incompetence.
All right. I've got to get a break in. But when we come back, I want to take on one other development in the governor's race. And Charles, I'm going to turn to you on this when we get back from this break. Right now, Jimmy Carter and Rosalynn Carter are down in Plains with Stacey Abrams. And I want to get your take first, Charles, on how important it is to have the Carters at your side in rural Georgia. We'll do that after this.
How would you like to be transported to the wizarding world of Harry Potter, visit a tropical paradise, or explore Jurassic Park? You can do all this and more if you're the winner of our drawing for a customizable vacation to Universal Studios in Orlando, including hotel and tickets to your choice of three amazing theme parks. With your support now at gpb.org, you'll give GPB's fall fund drive a head start, and you'll automatically be included in the drawing. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Tom Faust just told me that that 2 o'clock news conference is just now getting underway. That's President Trump. Tom, is he doing this as a straightforward news conference? What? Oh, he's with the president of Poland. So, I mean, we haven't had, Andra, an actual news conference in which a president stood before reporters in, I don't know how many months now. I've lost track.
Yeah. It's been a long period of time. I mean, it's not that unusual. I've just recently read lots of news conference transcripts. So these types of news conferences where you're supposed to do four questions usually.
Right, exactly.
You know, two of them go to the other president.
Right.
You know, is sort of, you know, what's going to happen. And then it's just going to be a question of what the shout outs.
Yeah, right? But he'll certainly be asked about Kavanaugh, and we'll see if he is able to exercise the kind of restraint he's shown so far. All right, Charles. So the Carters are down there in Plains, in their hometown, Jimmy's hometown, with Stacey Abrams. She's going to unveil her rural health care plan. Boy, you got to say, Charles, number one, she has been focused in a laser-like way on health care. And now to talk about it in terms of rural health care specifically, that in and of itself is something that's noteworthy for us. But then to have Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter decide, how important is that?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, survey research shows that Georgians are more concerned about health care than just about anything else. And therefore, her efforts to broaden it and says that she's elected governor, that it's going to be more available and that this would then keep some of these hospitals open is very smart. And of course, Jimmy Carter hasn't faced the electorate now in, about four decades. When he was running in Georgia, he was getting a sizable share of the vote in rural Georgia, and he was getting a lot of white votes out of rural Georgia. Those votes have been gone now since 2002, and no one else has been able to bring them back. Now, whether that's going to be brought back this year, I think it's questionable. Now, clearly there are an awful lot of African-Americans who live in rural Georgia, too, and across the Black Belt. And part of Abrams' strategy is to try to maximize turnout in that component. But her message, I think, does have some potential to bring in some white voters, whether it's with Jimmy Carter or not.
So, you know, there have been people who are talking about Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum and Ben Jealous in particular as sort of this sort of anti-deracialization wave. And so, you know, people like Barack Obama, people like Cory Booker, and to a lesser degree, even Kamala Harris, you know, usually sort of emerged as trying to be racially transcendent when they were running for statewide office. And the three Black gubernatorial candidates in this cycle don't necessarily appear to be doing that. They, you know, are unapologetically who they are, and they talk about justice issues, and they talk about them in open and frank ways. But at the same time, there are also ways that you do still have to put a multiracial coalition together. And so this is where Abrams is being transcendent. So she's not neglecting African-American voters, and she's not counting on getting those white voters back into the fold. She's going to grow her base with voters of color, but she's also going to try to win as many non-voters of color as possible by reaching out to these populist bread and butter issues as well. And so I think healthcare is a transcendent issue.
Andra, I wish I remembered what the issue was, but a few shows back, Andra was on the show, and you were making the point. We were talking about a fairly progressive liberal position, if you will, that Abrams had taken on an issue. And you said, yes, she's a progressive, but she better be cautious about some of her, she better be able to fine-tune her progressive agenda. And in Senga, what's beautiful, what I think I hear Andra saying is, in this case, she does have a transcendent issue. This is an issue that white and black, rural, urban voters can all embrace. It's a pretty smart issue, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and she has a personal narrative about healthcare. You know, it's not like, you know, she is making this up or saying, hey, you know, if this happened, you know, she has a narrative about healthcare and the role that, you know, lack of access to resources has played in her life. And so I think that makes her credible as well. And I think that Stacey does do well with embracing who she is. That's what Andra is talking about. Embracing who she is, not, you know, backing away from race issues, not backing away from gender issues, but really, you know, hitting them head on. And I think that's what people are really looking for, you know, not someone who's kind of, you know, racially ambiguous. No shade intended, but racially ambiguous, but, you know, really trying to be everything to everybody, but really someone who's like, listen, this is who I am. This is my belief system and my values, and this is what I want to do for the state of Georgia. And Stacey Abrams is that person.
Another reason that it makes sense is that healthcare is the type of issue where Democrats may have some advantages.
Yeah.
So, you know, people don't like Obamacare, but they're actually the main aspects of the bill in public opinion polling. People show that
Kevin,
they actually support that.
Your last AJC poll had healthcare registering well with both Republicans and Democrats.
It's the number one issue for Democrats, healthcare in Georgia. And people love the you know, they hated Obamacare, but they love the specifics of Obamacare, the pre-existing condition being the main thing. By the way, everyone, I just heard from Greg Bluestein, our reporter down in Plains, and they're still awaiting the Carters and Stacey Abrams. So that's been the theme of the show today, awaiting the president. We're still waiting.
Charles, I can't help but be interested in, and I know this is going back many, many years. It's how fascinating, though, to have Jimmy Carter in Plains, Georgia, campaigning with an African-American candidate for governor of this state. When you think about how he ran his victory campaign, the campaign he won in 1970, when he couldn't have gone further to the right in terms of race and issues around race. There's something kind of remarkable about this moment, even though we're talking about many, many years later. Yeah?
Well, yeah, right. In 1970, he ran as the George Wallace candidate.
Yeah.
He was criticizing Carl Sanders, his main opponent, for not having invited Wallace to the governor's mansion. And Carter says, if I'm elected, George Wallace will always be welcome in the governor's mansion. Now, Carter did, you know, change, pivoted 180 degrees 2 months after the general election, about 4 or 5 months after the runoff. And in his inaugural address, you know, that's where he says that the time for us to talk about race in Georgia is behind us. We're not going to do that anymore. So he quickly pivoted. But, you know, he ran the strong racial message appealing to the less, what we used to call back then the Lester Maddox voters, who were the anti-desegregation, anti-civil rights voters.
Yeah, you know, and Kevin, we played that soundbite from the inaugural speech on Political Rewind before. It was a stunning moment, given the racist kind of campaign he'd run. And it also, the New York Times put it on the front page of their paper the next day, essentially saying Carter is in the vanguard of the new South. Well, maybe in 2018, we are getting to a new South.
If you'll recall, right, there were moderate Democrat governors elected that year in southern states, right?
Yeah, that's right. And Senga, you're shaking your head. We haven't made it yet.
No, we have not. We're not. No, I'll leave it at that.
That kind of reminds me, I don't want to get off too far, but that kind of reminds me of the fairly lame opening number of the Emmys last night, the point of which is they were all patting themselves on the back for having solved, you know, problems of, you know, of race, problems of gender issues and that sort of thing. And, of course, none of that has turned out to be true. One last question about Carter. For you, Charles, can Can this guy, Jimmy Carter, somehow rekindle a yellow dog coalition? We talk about Stacey Abrams needing to bring out a larger percentage of African-American voters right. than ever before, having to bring out women voters who are maybe on the fence. But what about this? Stacey Evans tried to rekindle the Yellow Dog Democrat coalition and got nowhere. Can Carter help Abrams do some of that?
Well, he couldn't help his own grandson four years ago.
Yeah, but his grandson didn't run as a Democrat. His grandson sort of ran as a, I'm not quite a Democrat, and I'm sort of, you know, a conservative. I'm not sure it's the same thing, is it, Charles?
Well, we got probably, and again, best based off of exit polls and other things, you know, roughly low 20s in terms of the percent of white voters in the state who will vote for a Democrat. Now, again, if Abrams can get into the upper 20s, then with strong black turnout, yes, she wins. So, you know, if he can help boost it to that, then he plays an important role. But, you know, getting back to the days, again, what we were talking about a few minutes ago, where Democrats were easily dominant, not going to happen. I mean, even 20 years ago, we were saying, well, you could win with 40% of the white vote. Well, now it's probably closer to 30%. Yeah. And maybe that's what we're going to see going into the future.
Yeah.
Andra?
I completely agree with that. I mean, I think if there's one more thing, I want to get back to this healthcare thing.
Sure.
I've looked at data in other states nearby. And one of the things I was surprised by, I was looking for other stuff, but one of the things I saw was sort of if somebody thought that healthcare was salient, that actually increased their propensity in the particular election that I was looking at of voting for a Democratic candidate. And so it's one of those questions where I'm now like, ooh, I'm going to test this question here in Georgia. And sort of given what I've seen elsewhere, I suspect that I'm, you know, there might be similar types of correlations here.
All right. Let's do this. Let's get our second break of the show out of the way because we want to move on. We can't ignore the Kavanaugh controversy on the show today. Not only talk a little bit about what's happening in Washington, but what the panel thinks it could mean for races across the country. I said yesterday in talking about the fact we were going to do this show today that we used to say that all politics is local. We now know with Trump in the White House, all politics is national and has an impact on whatever is going on in local races. And that's certainly going to be true of the Kavanaugh controversy. So let's get our break out of the way and come back with more Political Rewind.
GPB's Fall Fund Drive is right around the corner, but don't wait to do your part. Your support now at GPB.org will give the campaign a strong start and keep the programs you rely on and enjoy coming to you on GPB. You'll also have a chance to win a customized vacation package to Universal Studios in Orlando with your choice of hotel and passes to amazing theme parks, including the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. You could be our lucky winner. Go to GPB.org and click donate. And thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the evangelical sexual purity and abstinence movement with Linda K. Klein. Her new book, Pure, is part memoir, including the story of how she left the church. It's also based on conversations she's had with other women about how the evangelical purity movement has affected their sense of identity and their sex lives. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and GPBnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I am here in the studio today with Kevin Riley. He is the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and we are glad to have you with us, Kevin. And Sangha Burton, she is a professor of media and film at Emory University. Dr. Andra Gillespie, associate professor of political science at Emory, and Charles Bullock joins us from out in our at WUGA in Athens. By the way, before we go on, I know that some of you, I mean, you not only write us when you're upset about the tone of the conversation, but you've said to us how much you like these new Political Rewind cups, these ceramic cups. Kevin, they're pretty cool, aren't they?
Yeah, the only problem I have is there's only water in them.
Well, you know, I think I said when we first got them that this was one of our senior vice president's efforts to kind of have fun with the red Solo cups that we have used in the studio for a long, long time. But now they're branded. And I mention them to you because I think if you pay attention to GPB radio, those of you who've been saying, how do we get those cups? You'll be hearing in the next week or so exactly how you can get them. I can't say any more right now. Stay
oh, I'm
tuned.
I'm locking my dial.
We'd love to get them out to you.
Absolutely. I got to have one.
All right. Enough of that. Kevin, and then I let you have the first shot, and then we open this up. We are waiting, I think, with bated breath for Monday, when the Senate Judiciary Committee has agreed that they will take up testimony from Christine Blasey Ford. I called her Ms. Ford yesterday. We've subsequently learned she likes to be known by Blasey, so we will call her that from now on. She, of course, alleges that she was sexually attacked by Kavanaugh back when they were in high school. And at first it appeared that Republicans really wanted to just push hard to get this confirmation process finished, get Senate Judy to vote on Thursday, and then they had to back off. I wonder now if Brett Kavanaugh, if there's any win for Brett Kavanaugh and the Republicans are backing him right now.
Well, I don't want to sound cynical, but I suppose I will. I mean, in the end, the Republicans are in charge of this process. I think they have learned through the many things that have happened, going all the way back to Anita Hill, that when something like this happens, the process has to honor and respect the person who's come forward. But
That happened when Anita Hill was? I just want to make sure.
I didn't mean to imply that. I mean, that was one of the most painful episodes in American politics, I think. I mean, when you watch that or you read about it or anything, and I mean, it was awful. And I think that they're trying to make sure that doesn't happen again for obvious and good reasons. But in the end, I have a hard time believing their choice won't be confirmed. I mean, let's recall that Clarence Thomas was confirmed through all of that, no matter what happened. I mean, he was confirmed, and in this case, Republicans are in complete control.
That was 1991. That was a long time ago in terms of how we've evolved as in our understanding, I think, of issues like sexual assault, sexual abuse, sexual harassment, whatever. And Senga, I want to play for you, since you're all about, you know, atmospherics, communications, I want to play for you sound from Orrin Hatch, Senator Orrin Hatch. He was on the Judiciary Committee when Anita Hill came before them. He was very hard on her back then. He was one of the people who really went after her.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what he said just yesterday about Ms. Blasey.
Do you think that any of these claims are legitimate?
No, I don't. I think this woman, or whoever she is mixed up. But I can't speak for her. All I can say is, no, I don't. I know the judge very, very well. I know how honest he is. I know how straightforward he is. I know how he stands up for what he believes and what's right. And frankly, if you were going to believe anybody, you'd believe him.
And Senga, this coming from, and look, I'm one of them myself, an old white man, mm-hmm. talking this way. He talked it in such disparaging terms about Anita Hill in 1991, and although Ms. Blasey is white, it has that same condescending ring to it. She's mixed up. You know, whether you think that Kavanaugh should be confirmed or not, whether you believe her story is true or not, this is exactly the danger Republicans are facing with this. This is not going to help them win women votes, is it?
No. And, you know, Orrin Hatch has a playbook, and he uses it consistently. And this is straight out of the playbook. I mean, from 1991. Disparage the victim, pretend like, oh, you know, women can't decide or determine what means yes and what means no, when they are consenting, when they're not consenting. Oh, it's such a gray area. And, you know, but we know plenty of people who don't have to rape or sexually assault women to have sex with them, right? So for someone to actually accuse you means typically that there is something that has happened that may not be proper. All right. And so Orrin Hatch is doing exactly what he did in 91. He is hoping that we will continue to do what we do, which is, oh, we pretend that we have greater awareness. We know more about these things. We know the laws. You know, we're coming to this understanding. But ultimately, you know, people do have their belief systems. And the idea that women cannot consent to sex, people still believe that. You know, people believe that women are objects to be taken and adorned and to be done. to be handled the way that they want to be based on male fantasies and perceptions and ideas.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
So I'm like, you know, this idea that, yeah, we have more information. Of course we have more information. I mean, there's the internet. But the idea that people behave differently because we have more information is a misnomer.
Charles, one of the issues here is that we have not heard her talk herself yet. But the reporting we're getting from her, she is an imperfect kind of witness in terms of the comments that are coming from her lawyer. And that is not to suggest that her allegations are not real, but she doesn't remember exactly when this happened. They were teenagers. What that's done is to sort of open the door, I think, for people to have an excuse for not wanting to accept her. But we'll all see how that plays out. What happens when she gets on national television and tells her story and it's compelling?
That's right. Yeah, that's, I think, very much it. How believable is she? Because right now it's kind of he said, she said. So I think people will be looking at that. And, of course, for an awful lot of folks, they're going to be viewing it through their own partisan perceptual screens. So, you know, for some folks, it isn't going to make a bit of difference one way or the other. They're already pretty much locked into a position. But within the Senate, evenly divided, you're probably looking at maybe four Republicans for who really, this is going to be critical.
I think, Andra, that the reason I said I'm not sure there's a win for Republicans on this in the long, twofold. Number one, it's how they deal with her, and so far Orrin Hatch is the perfect example of how you do not want to deal with this. But second is, she is likely to have a very dramatic story that the entire country will watch her tell. And it's hard to imagine that Brett Kavanaugh will be able to sit there, and even if he's believable, it's hard to imagine how he can come back from someone who has apparently this terrible story to tell. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are lots of things, and I think that this is a horrible situation.
Yeah.
It is horrible for the victim, the alleged victim in this case, and then this case, because it has become a political melodrama. Also, people are taking sides in part because we're polarized, but also in part because of the ambiguities in the case that are just a function of the fact that this happened over 35 years ago. I think the liabilities for the Republicans are, if you have this panel of Republican men on the Judiciary Committee who, if they grill or mistreat Ms. Blasey, then, or Dr. Blasey, then that's a problem. And if they're going to act like Orrin Hatch, then that's a problem. And then there's also, and it could be a particular problem for somebody like a Ted Cruz who's running for office right now and is starting off with a charm deficit to begin with. And then there is the other problem of, even if you win, if the optics are bad and people are incensed and Republicans end up losing seats as a result of it, or races that shouldn't have been competitive now all of a sudden become more competitive, which is a very likely outcome. And then there is the issue of sort of the specter of, even if Judge Kavanaugh is exonerated, even though this isn't sort of a criminal legal case, you know, this is the second Supreme Court justice who would be serving, who's had the specter of sexual harassment hanging sort of over his career. And so, you know, there's just so much here. And then there are these larger issues that we have to think about how we raise our boys, what goes on in high schools where kids are unsupervised and have access to lots of resources and money. There is the issue of Judge Kavanaugh and sort of the "I was drunk" excuse, which isn't an excuse for anything.
Well, of course, he insists that this didn't happen at all, so he has not made up an excuse saying, "Gee, I was drunk, I don't remember."
Right, but I mean, his friends
have
talked about stuff, and apparently what went on in their high school suggests that there was a lot of drinking that went on. So if he doesn't remember, it may be legitimate, but it's for other reasons that raise character issues that are problematic. So I'm not casting aspersions on Judge Kavanaugh. I know that these are all allegations, and he has the right to sort of, you know, speak for himself. But again, this issue of sort of drinking and drunkenness is a problem, and sort of, you know, how accountable are somebody when they actually are too blacked out to remember what happened? These are all things that cause us as a society to step back and think about how we raise our children and how we treat each other.
Yeah, and I do think it's important. I think you make a wonderful point there, Andra. I mean, they were 15 and 17 at the time this supposedly went on. I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, they were kids. And this is also going to kind of bring that out. I mean, how far back in someone's life can we go? You know, are we going to be talking to their kindergarten teachers at some point and find out that the kid was, you know, wouldn't take his nap?
Okay, so here's why I think that seeing her on national television in Senga is important. You know, what Kevin Riley said just now is the first thought I had when I first heard the news. Oh, well, I may were teenager. The first word I heard was, oh, he was whatever, coming on to her. It was only when I heard the detailed way in which she talked about what she alleges he did to her that it suddenly became for me more than, as Michelle Goldberg in her column this morning, in the headline in her column this morning, said, boys will be Supreme Court justices. So the nature of her allegation, I think, removes it from this notion of, oh, well, how can we go back to when you were a teenager and hold you accountable for your behavior?
Yeah, I think you can, particularly when you're looking at Supreme Court justices. This is someone who's going to have a job for life and be making rulings that are going to affect, you know, large amounts of people. So you go back as far as you need to go, I think. But in this particular case, I just find it interesting some of the rhetoric that's surrounding it and the conversations that people are having, you know, with the burden of proof already being placed on Dr. Blasey. I think it's interesting that the idea that, you know, she's an imperfect victim because she can't remember because of so many years ago. But the assumption is that Kavanaugh is just going to remember. He knows that he didn't do anything, although it was many years ago. You know, so it's kind of like the kind of discussion or discourse that we're having about this is really falling in line with dominant ideas about women and sexuality and what happens when they speak up, like what happened to Anita Hill. And so I don't think that because it's 2018 that we've gone any further, because it looks the same way to me, other than the fact that this is a white woman and Anita Hill was a black woman.
I got to jump in because we are rapidly running out of time. Charles, yes. I hate to do this to you, but I got 20 seconds for you to tell me, are candidates in Georgia, a Brian Kemp, other congressional candidates in the 6th and 7th district, you know, a Karen Handel, are they going to have to answer for this controversy? And if so, is it going to hurt them?
No, I don't think they have to answer for it, but what this may do is it may mobilize more women voters.
There you go.
We know that women voters are more likely to be Democrats than men voters, so it could certainly impact them that way.
All right. We're completely out of time for today's show. Charles Bullock out in Athens, thank you so much. And Senga Burton, appreciate your being here. Kevin Riley, Dr. Andra Gillespie, thank you, too, for being here for Political Rewind. We are back tomorrow with another Political Rewind at 2 o'clock. I hope you'll join us then. And then we're here again on Friday. Have a great afternoon. See you tomorrow.